We're going to take a short break for one of our sponsors. I haven't tried this one, but it looks well worth checking out if weight loss has been an ongoing challenge for you. Robody pairs medication options with diet and exercise modifications to achieve your desired goal. Before being prescribed any medication, patients complete an online medical visit, lab test, and more to see if you're right for their program. You can sign up online, which means no scheduling a doctor's appointment, no commute to the doctor's office, and no waiting rooms. Their data shows that average weight loss is 15 to 20% in 1 year with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to ro.co/untangle. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 a month for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. That's ro.co/untangle. Now, back to our show. We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from Muse, the brain-sensing headband that helps you meditate and a five-star app meditation studio. I'm your host, Patricia Karpus. We're hoping that your meditation practice is giving you exactly what you need to stay calm, grounded, and resilient wherever you are this spring. And if you're new to meditation or want to deepen your practice, it's a great time to check out choosemuse.com for great deals on your Muse headband. Today's guest is Dr. Ruben Naaman, a psychologist, clinical assistant professor of medicine, and sleep and dream specialist at the Andrew Weil Center for Integrative Medicine at the University of Arizona. He's become a leader in the development of integrative approaches to sleep and dream health. As a sleep expert, he looks at sleeping and dreaming as spiritual practices and shares how we can better understand who we are through our dreams, through our unconscious. And some of his ideas might seem radical. We tend to, he says, think that dreaming is a subset of waking life, but he's suggesting that waking life just might be a subset of dreaming. He explains lucid dreaming and how we can be sleeping and conscious at the same time. If mindfulness is about becoming aware of subtle daytime waking experiences, then lucidity, he says, is a bit like mindfulness of the night. There's a lot of mystery in the worlds of sleep and dreams, and Ruben has tapped into a bit of this here. Now, here's Ruben. Ruben, it is so great to have you on Untangle today. I'm really excited to dive into these topics.
Well, thank you, Patricia. I'm happy to be here.
I am curious why you chose originally to study sleep and dreams. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I have to say, when I hear a question like that, what goes on in the back of my mind is another question is, why aren't we all doing this? Because there's a presumption that we make, that we live with in our world, that what we're doing now, waking consciousness, ordinary consciousness that carries us through the day, that this is the gold standard. Waking is where it's at. So sleeping and dreaming are considered secondary, subservient states of consciousness. They're only there as an underpinning of waking life. It's like studying trees and forgetting that they have roots, which I think we typically do when we think of a tree. We think of what we can observe above ground, and it's beautiful and interesting and dynamic and serves us in so many ways, as waking life does. From the time I was young, I had an interest in what today we would call consciousness. maybe some of that's artistic, some of that I think had to do with my family's very traumatic background coming out of World War II. I think we can't fully understand dreaming. We try to, but we can't understand it without acknowledging that it lives primarily in the world of sleep and vice versa. And this is a huge issue today. It's the reason I think we as a culture and sleep medicine are failing. We're absolutely failing to deal with sleep issues because we don't recognize that dreaming is as critical to our sleep as sleep is to our sleep.
Why do you think that we don't recognize that? Do you think it's because those who are studying the brain can't, is it like the neuroscientist versus the psychologist, or what's the reason that we're not getting that part of it?
I think the basic answer is, as a culture, and this includes scientists, I think we're afraid of the unconscious. We are afraid of what lies deep inside of us. In more modern times, even if you look at Freud's writing, original psychoanalysis, Freud believed that the deepest part of the self, the personality, was what he called, in German, he called it das Es. In American psychiatry, we call it id. We have the id, the ego, the superego. But id is a Latin term, but Freud called it, in German, he called it it, I-T, it. What was at the heart of who we are was it. It was just this vast repository of pretty horrific impulses that there was something terrible deep inside of us. And historically, in short order, we saw an alternative emerge in the early 1900s, the work of Robin May in particular, who began to say, you know, it's not the id, and he started calling it the inner child. It's a very different picture. There's something beautiful and innocent and naive in the heart of who we are, and intelligent. In our world today, we're so materialistic. What was really understood thoroughly as the mind is now getting translated into the brain. My brain made me do it. I believe in the brain. I've studied them. I think it's a mistake to use the neurological model to try to understand personal experience. So I think that's part of the reason in sleep medicine, we study what goes on in the brain in great detail. We study neural networks and neurochemistry as it affects sleep and dreams. The truth is, I said, my truth is the brain doesn't sleep. The brain doesn't dream. We do. It's something we do as people. It's a subjective experience. And I think we so need to resuscitate our regard for that.
But I think that's a very difficult concept for people to hold. This is why I was so excited to interview you. Yours is a much more integrative approach. And you say that you invite subjectivity back into science and you integrate the spirit back into these discussions. And I think the challenging thing is, what is the difference between brain versus mind? And it sounds like you're calling mind something that includes the brain and the unconscious. How do you define the difference between brain and mind?
I think of the brain as a medium for the mind. There's been debate about this over the centuries. Does the brain produce consciousness? Can we reduce it to these neurological shenanigans? And there's this emergent property. Some of my colleagues here, Tucson, where I live, is the home to the International Science of Consciousness Conference. And an interesting mix of people, from scientists who are trying to prove that consciousness is an epiphenomenon of the brain versus others who believe that the consciousness is independent, kind of like radio waves that get channeled through other medium. I don't know that there's a scientific answer to that. There's nothing in science that can prove or disprove that. It's a question of where we focus. We tend in our world to focus on the material. With regard to dreaming, one of the most common references to the term dream reduces it to residential real estate, as in the American dream. The American dream is a house. Houses are great. I love my house, but it's not a dream house. It's a house. It's a physicality. We keep trying to reduce the non-physical to the physical. And I think when we honestly ask ourselves what's important in life, it's really hard to limit that to the physical. We talk about things like love or creativity or artistic expression. We can't capture spirit. It's mysterious. The language of the dream, for example, is poetry. We can journal our dreams in a literal way, but when it comes right down to it, it's another life. Again, using the dream as an example, whatever we believe, and even if we believe dreams are nothing but this flotsam jetsam that gets kicked out of the brain at night when it's doing house cleaning, The reality is, even hard-ass scientists will tell you dreams are meaningless when they dream. When we dream, we believe we're awake. We experience the dream. When we wake up, we think the dream is meaningful or meaningless. When we dream, we experience dreams as being meaningful. And they impact us. They impact our physiology. They impact our brains in much the same way waking does. So there is another world, if you will. One of my friends and colleagues, Gary Schwartz, along with Rupert Sheldrake and Charles Tartt, a number of other people, published a beautiful paper. It's a manifesto about how important it is that science not negate subjectivity. It's published in Frontiers a few years ago. But these are some of the most renowned scientists around the world saying that there's nothing in science that negates spirituality. And there's certainly nothing in spirituality that negates science. They can live side by side.
If we step back for a second and build a foundation or a framework for this conversation, do you think it's easier for some people to understand the scope and magnitude of sleep and dreams if you cover sleep architecture? Like, what is sleep? What are dreams? How do these go together? And why is this so important to our waking self, other than that it's X amount of time or 35 or so percent of our time?
So sleep architecture, as an example, it's a map of what science has discovered about what goes on in the brain and the body during sleep, and it's very important. But it's a mistake to think that that is sleep. That's a map of correlates of sleep. That's what happens when we experience sleep. Here's some interesting ways. So there's fascinating literature about sleep that comes out of Tibetan Buddhism, out of Hindu writings, Advaita Vedanta, Christian mysticism, Kabbalah. And there's a common thread, these notions that go way back thousands of years, that we can be aware of sleep. Now, sleep scientists will tell you, by definition, it's impossible to have awareness of sleep, with the exception of dreaming. We're aware when we dream. But what that does is it sort of sections sleep off as something that's inaccessible. In our world, people believe that only well-trained scientists, healthcare people like myself, we have this secret access. I understand sleep. It sort of baffled me that you can run into a four-year-old who's a great sleeper and they've never picked up or read a sleep medicine text. How can it be? It makes no sense. But the truth is that we have access to sleep, and we actually can cultivate the experience of being asleep. And I think it's important for people to know, so we just don't get eliminated in the name of expertise in science from a direct experience of sleep. I think dreaming is critical here. From a very practical standpoint, we can't really get into healthy sleep or come through and get out of a night of healthy sleep without dreaming. And dreaming is so downplayed in sleep medicine. Ironically, what we call medicine today is rooted in Asclepian, old antiquity traditions in Greece, from the Greek god or the character Asclepius. There were thousands of Asclepian temples. He's considered the father of modern medicine. And in Asclepian treatment, they were integrated. They used nutrition, botanicals, massage, bathing, but their primary source of intervention was dreaming. And there's such a great irony today that medicine in general and sleep medicine in particular so disregards dreaming. It's what's missing for people who struggle with insomnia. And when I work with patients, I still have a small practice. I teach people, I help them access their own dreams. We have to be comfortable with that expanse of consciousness to get to sleep and to stay asleep.
We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute, casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is, "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping, available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show. You're saying that understanding dreams is a path towards helping with insomnia. So we know from the brain there are several stages. There's deep sleep, there's light sleep, and there's REM sleep. And what the scientists tell us is that dreaming happens when we're in the REM part of our sleep cycle. How do we access our dreams? How do you talk about dreams when you're working with someone who has insomnia? And are you talking about it as it relates to the REM state, or are you not even looking at the different stages of sleep when you're talking about dreams?
We can come at it in different ways. From the scientific perspective, we've had data now, a lot of data, showing that most awakenings in the middle of the night. So there are two basic kinds of insomnia, the sleep onset, where people can't fall asleep at the beginning of the night, and sleep maintenance types of insomnia, where people fall asleep and they routinely wake up and can't get back to sleep. That latter type is the most common form of sleeplessness or insomnia, and it is most frequently associated with the onset of REM sleep. It's as if you're sleeping, you see a dust cloud on the horizon, or you hear the beginnings of a rumble, a stampede. The dream is coming, and dreams frequently carry emotion, and people often wake up. By the way, Shakespeare captured this when Hamlet said, "To sleep, perchance to dream." The evidence is so clear. Number one, most insomnia is not sleep loss. It's actually dream loss. And number two, we awaken when the dream starts to come. And then I think at some level, we're so uncomfortable with relating to that dark, unconscious, mysterious, expansive spiritual part of ourselves that we learn, we reflexively, it's almost a phobia. That's too strong a word, but people are afraid of their dreams. And we can talk about why that is. So people lift up unconsciously, they wake up and they don't go back. You can't go from waking to sleeping without dreaming. And people try to get themselves sleepy. In fact, it's a little more technical than this, but what gets us to sleep is not being sleepy, it's being dreamy. The transition from waking into sleep is a dreamy kind of consciousness. And so people have to get comfortable with that. And this is true at the beginning of the night too. As we fall asleep, we go through what we call a hypnagogic process or hypnagogic dream. These dreams are not the typical REM sleep stories, the coherent narratives we get later in the night, but they're fast, they're kaleidoscopic. Images come and go. Sometimes a sound will dart through the head. And these dreams are reflections of the waking ego, the part of us that's running the show, letting go. The rider gets off the horse, if you will. The mind gets off the body, and really interesting things happen. We have to get comfortable with that. The waking self metaphorically dies when we go to sleep. That sense is so common, it appears in mythological and spiritual traditions around the world. In Greek mythology, Hypnos, the god of sleep, interesting character, is brother to Thanatos, the god of death. So there has to be this willingness to let go. And by the way, flip side, we are, in our code, we're addicted. And I don't use that term lightly. We are addicted to waking consciousness. You know, we think waking is where it's at, it's everything. And we try to use waking to leverage sleep. And the part of us, the part of me, the part of you that we have a part that we call I, the part of me that I call I is the waking self. I cannot sleep. And when my patients come in and say, "I can't sleep," I think, you're right. The part of you that you call I can't sleep, we have to be willing to relinquish that. And that immediately, the relinquishment of the ordinary waking self, the executive function, if you will, takes us into the dream. And by the way, when we dream at night, literally there's a disconnection from executive function in the brain and the limbic system, particularly the hippocampus. The body and mind separate.
And for those of us that either don't think we dream or can't remember our dreams, is that what you're calling that fear of the dream state, or is there something else going on there?
I think it's caused by that. I wrote a paper for the Annals of the New York Academy of Sciences 3 or 4 years ago entitled Dreamless, the Silent Epidemic of REM Sleep Loss. This is what we call a review paper. I just pulled data that was there. And we are in the midst of an epidemic. That's not too strong a word. It's a silent epidemic because we're not aware of it. An epidemic of dream loss. As a culture, probably in the Western world, we are dreaming less and less. Not necessarily any individual. So when we can't remember our dreams, it's possible we're just not attending to them. The way most people wake up in the morning, literally it's alarming. The alarm goes off and we dart out of bed. We awaken aiming toward the waking world. It's as if we rapidly turn from the dream world, we slam a door, we burn the bridge behind us, and we're in waking. So a lot of lack of dreaming, if you will, is a lack of recall, but much of it is actually the result of lifestyle. We as a culture consume way too much alcohol, even though I think there's some very essential uses for cannabis, medically and otherwise. We consume much too much cannabis. Alcohol and cannabis significantly impair REM sleep, significantly. The vast majority of psychiatric drugs used around the world today significantly interfere with REM sleep. Medications we use as we get older and our population is aging commonly include what we call anticholinergics, which significantly interfere with REM sleep. We go on and on and on. And when you step back and look at what we know about roughly the percentage of people, the numbers of people who are affected by all these, we are in the midst of a serious epidemic of dream loss.
What can we do to turn that around? And why is it important? I think I understand from everything you've already said why it's important, but do you think it's possible to recoup our dreams?
Yes. So let me say a little more, if I may, about why it's important. I think it's so critical. There's data, there's early data now showing that dream loss is associated with increase in chronic inflammation in the body. We've known for a long time the damaged patterns of dreaming. These are patterns we see in sleep architecture, reduced REM latency, early onset of dreaming, and poor quality dreams. We know that that is strongly linked to mood. Specifically, people who are depressed and anxious, their dreams are wonky. And I don't mean wonky in a good, mysterious sense. They're dreaming less. It's poor quality dreaming. Dreaming is a way of seeing. Going back to this notion of we dream in REM sleep, REM sleep is essentially this window that opens and closes rhythmically through the night. The difference, it's a picture window into the dream world. But we have known for 50, 60 years that there's a kind of dreaming that actually occurs outside of REM sleep. I think of REM as probably the most visible direct access we have to the dream, but we dream all the time. We say dreams come out at night for the same reason we say stars come out at night. Well, they don't. They're there all the time. Those of us who've had the opportunity to witness an eclipse in the middle of the day, it's surprising, but not. It's shocking, but not. Because what happens is you realize, oh my God, the stars are up there even in the middle of daytime. They're obscured by the brightness of the sun. Our dreams are obscured during the day by the brightness of waking consciousness, but we dream all the time. Jung introduced this notion or codified this notion of the waking dream. There's a really interesting continuity. In a sense, there's a river of consciousness that flows under the surface and it comes up to the surface rhythmically, even during the day, but big time at night. So dreaming is a big part of who we are. And I think so many of us now suffer because we live in this very constricted consciousness. We live in small worlds. We believe the sense of who we are is limited to what we can define rationally and productively in this world. So I think one of the most important reasons to dream is we come to better understand who we are. And part of that is those of us who, I think anybody who attends to their dreams on a regular basis, this sounds crazy psychologically, but we begin to lose, in a healthy way, I'll say we begin to lose our boundaries. When we dream, I can be me in my dream, I can be you, I can be me watching me, or I can be an animal, I can be here, I can be there. So the sense of self, the boundaries that define us become really permeable, which means that there's an association between the richness of our dreams and our capacity to have empathy in waking life. We practice empathy in our dreams. So we become bigger in a spiritual sense of that. Our sense of self is expanded. Our connectedness, I believe our ability to love, our ability to be creative, to see beyond the boundaries of ordinary waking consciousness. So those are good reasons.
How do you interpret dreams?
Probably most of what goes on in the name of dream interpretation or analysis is actually misleading and I would say harmful. There's a presumption that dreaming is a subset of waking life. And I'm suggesting that waking life is a subset of dreaming. In the Western world, most of us are familiar with this Christian notion that as it is above, so is it below. The earth is created in the image of the heavens. Humans are created in the image of the divine. So if we think of the dream as being the atmosphere of waking life, this more expansive outer world, when we experience an image, we dream about a bird or a tree or a person, we can try to understand that in two different ways. We can understand it by comparing it to a similar image in waking life. What that does, and that's the most common approach, we see this in dream dictionaries. So I'll understand the image of a bird, of a thunderbird, a cloud that whizzes by saying, oh, it's a bird, and it represents this in the waking world. What that does is it takes as it is above, so is it below, and it turns it upside down. Most dream work is based on the principle of as it is below in the waking world, so it is above in this expansive dream world, and it downsizes the dream. The dream is subsumed under waking consciousness. It shrinks the dream down, and it's comforting. It's, oh yeah, I know what that means. That's just this. That's just. But it basically folds everything back into the waking material world rather than letting the dream expand our sense of self and take us into this really rich, ineffable, mysterious world.
But when we're trying to understand, we need a language. So let's say we have a dream and it's a beautiful, expansive world. Are you saying it's not important that we interpret it as we might in our waking world? How would you interpret that?
Interpretation and analysis, they can be understood in different ways. It's interesting. So I've done a lot of dream work with people over the years, individually and in groups. And this is a sort of assumption that you have to be well-trained in the dream and in psychology and mythology. And the thing is, when people have an opportunity to share a dream, and when that individual is attended to, is listened to, the dream essentially tells its own story. The meaning of the dream is the dream. Sometimes, I mean, language can be very helpful. Some of the best dream work occurs in art and poetry. I've worked extensively with musicians, painters, writers, poets, and it's more effective, I would say, to try to capture the dream at that level. The meaning of the dream, when we do dream interpretation, we'll often ask, well, how does it feel when you're in this part of the dream? When you allow the dream, the story to be fully told, when it's shared and witnessed, the meaning is right there. I've come to believe that as interesting as it is to understand the meaning of any particular dream, it's more important just to understand that dreaming is meaningful. And when we attend to our dreams, that's not a hypothesis. It just is. It's like, oh my God, wow. And it always ends in a mystery. It always continues in a mystery. So I like the word understand because it literally suggests that we need to get beneath something. There's an implied humility. And here's another tie to sleep and dreams. The main reason people have insomnia, the vast majority of insomnia, is linked to what we call psychophysiological hyperarousal. And basically, people are flying at really high altitudes cognitively. They're stuck in thinking. And they're people, we talk about heart rate as a measure of health. We talk about head rate. I'm always curious about how many thoughts are passing through somebody's mind in any given minute. Hyperarousal, we live in high altitude waking. It's so high that we can't fully descend and land and sleep. But the antidote to hyperarousal is humility. It's coming down to earth. A humility, of course, comes, is related to the word humus. It's the ground. It's getting back grounded.
It's such a rich topic. And I'm going to ask, probably this is a superficial question, but do you think people who are more visual by nature dream more?
Roughly 80% of sensory stimulation through the brain is visual. It's just what we use a lot. When people talk about their dreams, they experience the dream, but dreaming is an out-of-body experience. We can say more about that, but meaning we use our senses in the dream, but they're not our waking world eyes or ears or nose or hands with touch. These are the other sense modalities, and often is what we call synesthesia. People will taste music or they'll hear an image. It all blends. In the waking world, we segregate. But no, I think we all have access to the dream, even people with congenital blindness dream in a different sense. But can I add one piece here? I was talking about humility Mary Oliver, the poet, has an incredibly insightful piece about sleep. I don't remember the whole poem, but it's called Sleeping in the Forest. And it starts with her saying, "I thought the earth remembered me. She took me back so tenderly, arranging her dark skirts and pockets full of lichens and seeds. I slept as never before, a stone on the riverbed." She talks about this process that we've forgotten about in our world. And let me introduce this by saying, in integrative medicine, we so champion the notion of body-mind oneness. And I think that's an essential antidote to this long-term segregation of body and mind. But the body and mind, although they operate in close cooperation, from a dream and sleep perspective, they are not one. To sleep well, we actually return, as in Mary Oliver's poem, we return the body to the earth. "I thought the earth remembered me." The body goes down in sleep. And if you will, the spirit rises. And this is reflected in something I hinted at earlier. There's a disconnection between prefrontal executive function and hippocampal limbic function. There is a disconnection when we go to sleep, and particularly in dreams. So it's the waking mind is no longer operating the body. And what happens in the body is really fascinating. The body goes through what we call autonomic nervous system storms. This is REM sleep, ANS, autonomic nervous system storms. The mind leaves, looks like the captain is gone, and the body gets wild. Respiration goes up and down. Heart rhythm is bouncing all over the place. Body temperature is dysregulated. When the mind leaves the body goes to town and plays. It gets wild. And I think the body needs a rest from the mind. It's like the mind, we ride the body. You know, we tell the body what to do. And sometimes with kindness and oftentimes with little regard to what the body needs to rest or needs to eat or needs to pee, and we don't let it. So there is a separation from the body standpoint. Sleep and dreams is an out-of-mind experience. And from the mind standpoint, particularly sleep, but particularly dreaming, is an out-of-body experience. So the mind is no longer constrained. The consciousness of the mind is no longer limited by the body. I can fly. I can time travel. I can see through walls. There's this beautiful expansion of consciousness. And I think those two are essential experiences. And in insomnia, the mind and the body do not separate well.
And so this keeps you out of any of the stages of sleep or dreaming.
It limits it. It's as if the mind is trying to fly, but it's tethered to the body and it's trying to drag the body into higher consciousness, and the body is stuck. Sometimes it's discomfort or pain, and the body holds on to the mind, but that separation is necessary.
Do you think that meditation helps with that separation?
I think it absolutely can. And this is a great question too. It's so interesting to explore. Over the years, like many of us, I've worked with long-term meditators with insomnia. And this is an overstatement or a simplification, but it's how we use the meditation. I think meditation can be used to help us expand out of the limitations of waking consciousness, and or it can help us become more comfortable with waking consciousness. And I think that depends on the intentions the individual brings to the meditation and, of course, the kind of meditation.
Can you describe what lucid dreaming is and start from the beginning for people who have never heard of this before?
I think most of us have had probably some spontaneous experience in lucidity. So lucid dreaming involves varying degrees of waking consciousness, waking awareness. Is co-consciously present during the dream. So I'm dreaming, and as I'm dreaming, I kind of know that I'm dreaming. Again, many people have had this spontaneously, and some people develop it. So there are two parts to lucidity. One is the awareness of the dream, just to be dreaming and know that you're dreaming. The other is using the dream. So the Tibetan Buddhists have a beautiful and arduous spiritual path called sleep and dream yogas. They teach their monks in this path to become aware. Through meditation, they cultivate awareness of sleep. I've referred to this in my first book as lucid sleep. So let me just touch on that for a second. Again, we're told that we can't be asleep and be conscious at the same time. That's just not true. Many of us can think back to sleeping in on a Sunday morning after a late Saturday night, and somebody comes in and starts to wake you up and you say, leave me alone, I'm sleeping. Well, you are. You're sleeping. You know you're sleeping and you are. And this is a more mundane example, but we can actually cultivate awareness during sleep. There's some beautiful writings by a woman named Mother, who was probably the best known disciple of Sri Aurobindo. And she spoke about and wrote about sleep, and she was an awakened individual. She stated she never, ever lost consciousness. She'd lie down and rest her body for maybe 3 hours a night. She'd close her eyes. And here's the thing. She never went to sleep because she never left sleep. There was a part of her that lived in sleep consciousness. And in our world, we think of sleep as a place we go to, like I'm going to sleep, like I'm going to New Jersey. But it's not. Sleep is the default in consciousness. We are all of us already. You and I, we're sleeping right now. Even when we're awake, sleep is a kind of, it's like stillness, okay? If you're maybe you're in a room with a bunch of people talking, and you wonder where the stillness is. Well, you never have to go to stillness. You simply have to eliminate the sound, the voices, and there it is. The stillness was there all along. Sleep resides beneath the din of waking consciousness, as does dreaming, I would say. So it's always there. Being lucid in sleep and dreams, it can really be helpful if we practice being aware of the part of us that is asleep and the part of us that is dreaming during waking.
That's so interesting because I pulled this quote of yours that says, if mindfulness is about becoming aware of subtle daytime waking experiences, lucidity is mindfulness of the night.
What brings to mind Ron Lang, R.D. Lang, you might be familiar with, a British psychiatrist who really studied the frontiers of consciousness. He wrote this tiny little poem about this. He said, the range of what we think and do, it's a poem about everything, right? The range of what we think and do is limited by what we fail to notice. And because we fail to notice that we fail to notice, there's little we can do to change until we notice how failing to notice shapes our thoughts and deeds. So for me, it's a humble call to the dream world. It's like noticing the periphery, letting consciousness, it's a wide angle lens, letting consciousness expand. And so that's where it all lives. There's a question of intention, what I'm willing to look for and willing to see. But getting back to lucidity, in the Western world, a lot of lucidity is about controlling the dream. It's really disturbing to me. This is how we treat nature, right? And we have, for centuries, we've looked at nature as a resource. We can go out without any regard to the ramifications of it. We can dam up rivers and strip mine and cut forests to pieces and pollute the air. We look at the world outside of us as a resource. This is happening with dreams. And I was invited by a well-funded company some years ago to work with them. And one of their mottos was dream hacking. And we see this all the time, as if the dream isn't alive, as if the unconscious doesn't have its own intelligence. We have to go in and dominate it. So I think lucidity, the practice of awareness, is really useful. But I think we need to be really cautious about hacking the dream. And just very recently, a large beer company, I'd say Coors Beer, hired a colleague of mine, a renowned dream researcher from a major university, to help create a commercial for the Super Bowl that would induce a quasi-lucid dream about beer. We know enough about this. We can do this. I think it's unconscionable. We need to recognize that the dream world, the dreamscape, is like the environment. It's the inner counterpart to the outer world. And we need to be respectful of it. There's an intelligence in it. We live with it.
What you're talking about with regard to Coors is how suggestible many people are, and then how we maybe misuse hypnosis, which is different from what you're talking about with dreaming.
Yes and no. I mean, hypnosis is a way of accessing the unconscious. I think whatever we do, we need to do it ethically, but we often use imagery in hypnotherapeutic processes. I think we come back to this question you opened with, which is, can we respect the unconscious? Can I trust the deepest part of myself and of other, of you? And can we recognize that there's something of great value rather than operating on the unconscious assumption that the depths of ourselves are not trustworthy?
There's so much rich information here and so much mystery. And my tendency is to try to find some clarity,
And I don't feel like I have a lot of clarity because it's so complex. If you had to summarize your best recommendations for sleep health and dream health, so really, how can we have a better night's sleep, whatever that means to the individual, and how can we be more present to our dreams? What would you say?
Yeah. The first thing that comes to mind takes me back to when we opened our discussion, realizing that sleep and dreams are the roots of the tree of daily life, that they are so much more important and so much more present. We all know that they're important, right? There's so much literature now and research and media pieces about this, but I think even more important. If you look at most sleep research, researchers sit down with sleep and with dreams and they say, hey, sleep, dreams, what can you do for us as waking people? And sleep and dreams answer in the affirmative, and we can do really good things. We'll improve your health and your immunity and your appearance and your productivity and on and on and on. The question is limiting. If we think of sleep and dreams only as subservient to waking life, we miss something. That sleeping and dreaming are ends in and of themselves. I think of sleeping and dreaming as spiritual practices, they're spiritual experiences. I would suggest that people reconsider their sense of sleep and dreams, not just as an essential practice to make them better at waking, and in and of itself, to really rethink sleeping and dreaming. I'll tell you, over the years, I've talked to lots of good sleepers as well, and they typically say things like, I really love sleep. And I get it. It's a different kind of relationship. It's not just like, I need sleep and can I take a pill to get there? But there's something so rich, particularly when we become more mindful and more lucid of it. So to reestablish a loving relationship with sleep, I think is foundational. And the other thing, we tend to think of sleep and dreams as being discreetly personal experiences, right? I close my eyes and go to sleep. I go into my own brain, my own mind, my own psyche. And then my partner who's in bed next to me, she closes her eyes and she goes into her world. I wrote a piece years ago entitled something like, Love Means Never Having to Say Goodnight. And it's based on this idea. I mean, we say goodnight like we're going to different places, but it's based on the assumption that sleeping and dreaming are personal, discrete experiences. I go into mine, you go into yours. It's just not true. So we sleep with. We sleep with the person next to us. We sleep with our beds and with our bedrooms and some of us with our pets. We sleep with the world around us. We sleep with the hemisphere. At any given moment on planet Earth, there's roughly 2 billion people sleeping, despite all the insomnia. So we sleep with the world around us. We sleep with night. We sleep with darkness. And we dream with the world around us. We impact each other so much more. So the recognition that it's relational, that it's not just me going into my own private dark world. We dream of ourselves. But as Carl Jung said, we also dream of what lies between us and the other. Dreaming can become collective. And we've seen so much of that in recent times around the pandemic. So that's another piece, is recognizing that sleep and dreams are shared experiences. And the third thing I'll say, and maybe the trickiest, and it ties into stuff we've talked about, I think sleeping and dreaming are spiritual practices. So this always reminds me of Plato when he was on his deathbed and his students gathered around and asked if he could summarize his life's work in a few paragraphs. And he said, I'll tell you everything I've ever learned in two words. He said, practice dying. Practice dying. Maybe a softer term for most of us is letting go. And sleeping and dreaming are profound experiences. Whether we remember them or not, they're profound spiritual practices of letting go into a larger world and a more expansive consciousness. We die to the waking world and kind of are reborn or awaken in this beautiful, peaceful, serene sleep and mysterious dream world.
If I wanted to do one thing tonight to remember my dream before I fall asleep, what would I do?
Your question comes from some recognition that, wow, there's something in there worth tapping into. That I really believe that the dreamer inside of us is alive. Yeah, I think Rumi referred the unconscious as the great friend. And it's a cooperative effort. We don't have to force it. And there are little tricks we can do. The best way to remember dreams, and this is actually out of a Rumi poem, is to recognize the beauty in what we call grogginess. The word groggy comes from the English rum drink, grog. And there's a suggestion that we awaken drunk, right? And quick, get some coffee, take a cold shower, snap out of that place. But grogginess is an exquisite hybrid state of consciousness. It's part sleep, part dreaming, and part waking. And the best way to open a dialogue with our own dream world is to linger peacefully in grogginess, not to go chasing the dream like it's a butterfly with a net of cognition, but to kind of wait, linger in the grogginess, and the dream will come to us. It's like a puppy. It's a little shy. It's a little playful, but let the dream come. The dream lives in the yin and receptive feminine consciousness. If we introduce waking, it's like if we introduce, I'm going to capture this dream and analyze the crap out of it. I'm not going to cooperate. But once we do, once we get a glimpse of the dream, it shows up, there's an image of a tree or this or that, then we bridge it. Goethe, the great poet philosopher, reminded us to never share our dreams with an individual who doesn't respect dreaming. If we're lucky enough to have a bed partner who respects dreaming, it's a wonderful practice to share dreams with the person next to you in the morning. It so deepens intimacy. We learn so much about ourselves and one another. And or to journal the dream, to create a bridge between the dream world and the waking world. And the more we do that, the more we find we carry a sense of the dream with us. And we have less of this artificial segregation most of us live in between the night world and the day world, the sleep world and the waking, the dream world and the waking. So we begin to carry that sense of sleep and dreams into our day. And it just makes life bigger, richer. And to go back to your comment earlier, that it's somewhat confusing. Always reminds me of a great line in a Bob Dylan song where he said, I ain't afraid of confusion, no matter how thick. And many spiritual teachers say confusion is a high state. Our willingness to be confused is a willingness to live in mystery without having to reduce it to ordinary familiar concepts. So yeah, confusion is great. I do it a lot.
I know. I live in that world. This is such great information, and I love the way that you expressed all of this. So I thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.
Great to have Ruben with us today. For more about him and his work, check out drnaiman.com. Don't forget to check out choosemuse.com for your Muse sleep headband. And if you have any questions or suggestions for us, please share them at untangle@choosemuse.com. And have a great week. We will see you next time.